Hello everyone, this is Interested, the podcast for interested people. I'm Lizzie.
I'm Beth.
And welcome. Each week we bring a topic which the other person doesn't know about to share our fascinating topics of interest, which are both on the opposite spectrums of English and science. And if you're not a fan of expletives, then this is not the...
Expletives means swearing.
Yeah, if you don't like swear words, then this is not the podcast for you because we swear semi-frequently.
Okay, so...
I'm excited.
So I'm bringing an equation today. And it's actually an equation that probably, like, everyone who's done GCSE chemistry will have come across.
Oh, okay. So and I might know it.
Yeah. And it's the Haber process.
Completely so don't know it.
So that is, so it's okay. Basically N2 plus 3H2 goes to 2NH3.
I'm already lost.
Yes. So basically the reason why I wanted to do this was because I remember being at school, this is one of the things where you have to memorize it.
Right, yeah.
And I was like, oh, why do I have to memorize this equation? Why do all the chemistry teachers seem to assume that everybody knows about this and everyone thinks it's important? When I don't think it's important, I just want to do physics instead of chemistry.
That was me, just absolutely had no idea what anything was happening in chemistry.
And like, to be fair, even up until probably the second year of A-level, I didn't know why we kept talking about this.
Oh, right, okay.
So the Haber process, it's actually called the Haber-Bosch process. So Fritz Haber invented the process, but Carl Bosch made it industrial. And it is the way that we produce ammonia for fertilizer and also bombs.
Great.
So.
Okay. Doesn't ammonia stink?
Yes.
It's not a nice smell.
I think I'm going to start with the history. So Fritz Haber, he was an extraordinary chemist. He was also a winner of the 1918 Nobel Prize in Chemistry. He was the husband of Clara Immerwahr, very sorry for that pronunciation, who was the first woman in Germany to be awarded a doctorate in chemistry.
Whoa, that's so cool.
Yeah. And he was the feeder of billions and also the killer of a lot of people too.
Oh, no.
So he's not like Nikola Tesla, where he's a nice yeah. boy. Fritz Haber is the classic example of the scientist who uses his brains for bad.
Consciously uses his brains yes. for bad. Oh, no. Okay.
So he was born in Prussia, which is now Poland, but back then it'd just been part of Germany.
Yeah.
Because Germany had just been formed.
Yeah.
And he was really really patriotic. Mm-hmm. So he actually, because he was a Jew, he was a German Jew.
Yeah.
He converted from Judaism to Christianity.
Oh, okay.
And other people have said that he did that to be more accepted into the German community.
Okay.
Whether that's true or not, I'm not really at a place to say.
What time was he living, sorry?
1868 was when he was born.
1868, okay.
Yeah, so quite a long time ago.
Yeah. Ages ago.
Yeah. He also believed that in peacetime, a scientist belongs to the world, but in wartime, he belongs to his country. Something that a fellow German scientist called Albert Einstein, you may have heard of him, deeply opposed. So because of this, in the run-up to World War I, he decided to dedicate his brains to helping the German war effort. This undoubtedly caused a lot of tension between him and his wife, Clara, because she was a pacifist.
Basically, before you have the whole
Haber process,
yeah,
everybody was looking for natural nitrates. So we have, the atmosphere is actually like 78% nitrogen.
Okay.
So.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I remember something from science.
Yeah. But nitrogen in the air is N2, which okay. means it's two nitrogen atoms like held together and yeah. they have a triple bond.
Okay.
So if you think of one bond, that's like three of them. So you don't really need to understand about
okay.
the science. Just, it takes a lot of energy to split them up.
Okay.
And so plants and humans can't actually use the nitrogen in the air. Mm-hmm. But when they have nitrates, which is something bonded to, so like potassium nitrate, then that's really useful. So plants need that to grow, humans need that to grow.
Yeah.
Our DNA actually relies on having nitrogen. So
it has to be combined with another element to be useful to
us. Like nitrogen gas doesn't.
So we just breathe really it in and out and it's.
Yeah, it's really unreactive.
Okay.
So there are actually wars over nitrates. So. In India, they had this thing called saltpeter, which is, they call it fixed nitrogen when it's in this compound that you can use. So in India, they had a lot of fixed nitrogen in the form of saltpeter. And that was actually a significant contributing factor in the British decision to, like, take over India.
Oh, no. Okay. It's the empire.
That was how important it was.
Oh, wow.
And also in Peru, they had, like, this thing called guano, which is basically bird shit.
Oh, okay.
And bat shit, and they had, like, mountains of this.
Wow.
And so there was, like, a time where Peru was super, super rich because everybody wanted this.
They have so much shit.
Yes.
For growing stuff.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, yeah, so basically this was, so there was a population boom, and they didn't have enough fertilizer to feed people or land to feed people.
Yes.
So they used this fertilizer to grow crops, but also to make explosives, like gunpowder.
Oh, shit.
TNT, all of that stuff.
It's mad that it can be used for growing, which is the least, like, dangerous thing, really. And then it can also be used for destruction. It's pretty mad, isn't it? That's mad. Yeah.
And it's just really hard to find naturally. It does grow, like, grow in inverted commas because it's a crystal. So the crystals grow, not...
Yeah.
But it takes a really long time. So in England, they had these sort of mines. Not mines, but, like...
Fields?
Like they were basically like
quarries.
low troughs in the ground, and they would fill them with feces and urine and dead things, leave them there, and eventually there'd be like this shell of white crystals, which would then be scraped off. But this was really slow, so they also had them, I think in China, they had some of this saltpeter, but it was quite rare, and eventually it all got used up. Mm-hmm. So around Fritz Haber's time, they were getting it from... There was a war in the middle of the time, so now it's part of Chile.
Okay.
I think originally it was part of Peru.
Okay.
But the story of how... So that wasn't pure saltpeter, it was a form of fixed nitrogen that could be converted into saltpeter.
Yeah.
Which was what they used for explosives and fertilizer. And the story of how it was discovered was actually really cool. So these Indians, like native Indians, I hope that's the right term, probably
South
not.
South Americans.
Yeah. I'm quoting from a book.
Okay.
So, sorry.
Judge the book.
Yeah. So they were in the desert. It was part of the Atacama Desert. It's a specific region. And they were setting fire to, like, a dried up cactus to keep warm. And the whole ground suddenly burst into flames.
Whoa!
And they were like, oh my gosh, it's the devil.
Of course you would think that.
So they took a sample of the earth and they took it to a priest.
Yeah.
Who was obviously a missionary there. Yeah. And he knew enough about chemistry to know that it wasn't the devil, it was just some form of nitrogen. And he said, don't worry guys, it's not the devil, chucked out his window. And then a couple weeks later, he was like, hang on, all the crops that I grew there and around the place where I chucked the dirt are suddenly really tall and growing really well.
Wow.
But then at this time, the guano was still happening, so no one was interesting. Mm-hmm. So only after all the guano ran out, they were like, wait, that was that story about the priest chucking.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's a cool legend.
Yeah, that's cool.
But Germany does not have any saltpeter.
Right.
It was, I mean, it may, apart from obviously in mines, I guess, but you don't really want to have sewagey mines.
I'm putting my hand up to ask a question for everyone. Is like the peat bogs in Ireland, is that the same thing?
No.
Okay.
So saltpeter is salt and then P-E-T-R-E.
Okay, not peat bogs, P-A.
No.
P-A-T. Okay.
No, this is different.
Okay, cool.
Sorry,
I was just thinking of... If we can cut this out, but in year 9, like we read a book called The Bog Child. So I was like, wait, is this like the you know, like there was a person found in the bog, completely preserved because of
that's so cool.
It was really interesting.
Yeah,
I saw him.
Really?
Yeah, in the British Museum.
I'm so jealous.
Yeah, really cool. Yeah. But sorry, completely unrelated.
No,
I was like,
it's fine.
Is this The Bog Child?
No, it's not. It's different.
Okay.
Anyway, so Germany, it was the run up to World War One. So in 1909, mm-hmm. that's when he demonstrated his Haber process.
Yeah.
And this was massive because up until now, the Germans had to import all of their nitrates from Chile.
Which is a long way away.
Which is a long way away. Once the First World War started, the Allies blockaded that, so they were
The
Haber Process actually extended the German war effort in World War One by about 2 years.
Oh, really?
Yeah, otherwise they would have
come out.
Yeah, and also they reckon that experts, not me, reckon that Hitler would not have been a threat if they hadn't had the Haber Process. I mean, I feel like that's kind of having a lot of assumptions, because even if Haber hadn't discovered it, someone else would have.
Yeah, a lot of...
Yeah, so the World War One thing, I'm like, yeah, that makes sense.
But they were never too much.
World War Two, I'm slightly sceptical about, but I'm not an expert.
Because you're assuming about a lot several decades into the future.
Yeah.
Like, you can't really do that with history, it's not...
No.
You could do that forever.
Yeah, definitely.
If this didn't happen, then this would have happened.
Like, if
you don't know, because it didn't happen, so...
If humans never discovered fire, then Hitler wouldn't have been an issue either.
Yeah, that's so true.
So Haber discovers this process. By 1913, Bosch has industrialized it.
Okay.
So now Germany has like a factory just producing ammonia, which can then be converted into nitric acid, which can then be used for bombs.
Right. Without having to go all the way to Peru.
Yeah, or
Chile.
Chile, yeah.
Yeah. Or India.
Yeah. And so this was massive, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
And he wasn't just content with this. So as well as, you know, doing all the technology. And he was fully for this. Like, it wasn't just a scientist accidentally does this thing, which someone else then uses for bad. This
or was, like, Einstein was being pressured into splitting the atom.
I mean,
is that what he did?
It wasn't. The splitting the atom was very. It was a group.
Okay, cool.
Thing, but and Einstein
the
wasn't
Manhattan project.
Yeah, Einstein was there, but I wouldn't say that he was.
Okay.
Because there was Oppenheimer, who was.
Oh my gosh! Cut all of this out.
Don't worry. So Fritz Haber, he was fully. He wanted.
Consciously knew.
Yeah.
That he was.
He was trying to do this for the German war effort.
Yeah. To kill more people.
To make nitrates for explosives.
Ah.
Yeah.
Problematic.
Not only this, he also weaponized chlorine gas.
Oh gosh.
So he's a really lovely dude.
What does chlorine gas do?
So basically that was the first gas. You know when they talk about the green fog?
Yeah, I was just thinking.
That is chlorine gas.
Is it called mustard gas?
Mustard gas came later.
That's different. Okay.
So he was in Ypres on the front lines, smoking a cigarette, waiting for the right winds. He was like saying, you know, I think the winds are in the wrong direction today. Maybe not. Then when they're in the perfect gust strength, they didn't want the wind to be too strong, otherwise
it would just blow over.
He was like, this is the right time, this is when it will kill the maximum enemy soldiers.
Oh dear.
So he was there, he was like, yeah, release the canisters. So it blows, they release this chlorine gas. Chlorine's heavier than air, so it hovers around the ground.
Okay.
Right where, and it would fall.
People's faces were with the trenches.
Yeah. So it just fills up all the trenches, blows across the French lines. There are about 10,000 men. About half of them died within a couple minutes from asphyxiation and just suffocating.
That's horrific.
A survivor said it was like drowning only on land.
Oh my god.
And if you drink water, you die because it reacts.
Oh my word.
It's just horrific. I read some really awful testimonies.
Oh dear.
And I did not want to include them because it was too horrific.
Yeah. Just the fact that half the amount of that, 10,000 died.
Yeah.
No, thank you.
And so, yeah.
Ooh, I was about to say, well, at least it was quick, but then it probably wasn't. In terms of how horrific it was to die from it.
No, like, people were coughing up froth and...
Oh!
It's just really nasty.
So this guy is not exactly...
He is not.
Someone you want to have a hug with.
No.
His wife, Clara,
was a pacifist.
Wow.
She actually committed suicide because she was so upset about
Oh,
this.
Really?
Yeah. I'm going to do a little bonus extra episode on her because I want to do...
She was the first... She was the first person to get a doctorate
in Germany.
Oh, wow.
So I'll talk about her in an extra episode. But yeah, he also, not only that, it gets worse.
Oh gosh. How does that get worse?
He invents this chemical gas called Cyclone B.
Okay, and I think I've heard of this.
Yeah, you may have heard of this.
Okay.
So, as you know, he was Jewish by heritage.
Yeah.
They rejected that. Yeah.
Oh no.
When the Nazis came into power, He wanted to carry on helping the German war effort, even though they were Nazis.
Oh wow.
But they were like, either leave or die. So he ran away to Switzerland, but not before inventing this gas. He actually dies in Switzerland. But then when the Holocaust comes around, Zyklon B is the gas that's used to kill some of his relatives in the Nazi death camps.
Oh my word.
Yeah.
Wait, did he consciously do that?
I don't know if he knew that it was going to be used
for the Holocaust.
No, I don't think that. I doubt he was told about the final solution.
Yeah.
It's just really tragic he invented the gas that was used to kill all those.
If that's not karma.
I mean,
that's just horrific, isn't it? Yeah,
it's really awful.
Did he know that as well?
No, he was dead by then.
Okay.
I think. Yeah, I'm pretty sure he was dead.
Oh dear.
Yeah.
Wow.
He was a nasty piece of work. When he was making these gases and...
Oh, I bet he tested on animals.
He tested on German soldiers.
Oh, no.
So...
What?
Like, when he was trying to find the perfect way to release the chlorine gas, and some German troops actually died from this because it went wrong and...
Oh, no.
Yeah, it's just... Oh. Everything about him is like, wow, you're such an awful dude.
you're just so irredeemable.
And then 1918 happens, and he wins the Nobel Prize in chemistry. So to put this in perspective,
what?
World War One ends in 1918.
Yeah.
1919, he's awarded the prize for 1918. And if you think that's controversial now, imagine at the time when everyone was like, he's a war criminal. What are you doing?
What? Why did they do that?
Yeah, so this is where the other half of his story comes into play.
Oh, wow.
So the fact that the Nobel Prize Committee decided to award him the prize despite all of
the war crimes,
murder and awfulness.
Oh, gosh.
And Karl Bosch also got one later on.
Kind
of is a testament to how important the unintended consequences of the Haber process were.
Yeah.
So roughly half the nitrogen in your body comes from the Haber process today.
Oh, what?
About half the people on Earth would starve to death if we turned off all the Haber process factories.
Whoa.
Basically, so you have land.
Yeah.
And there's a limit to the land.
Yeah.
If everybody worked on farms using the most advanced methods, the Earth could probably support about 3.5 billion people.
Yeah.
Currently, we're at about 7.8-ish.
Yeah, double that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh my word. The only way we can support today's population. And is that why today's population is big? Because we've been able to support more people.
So otherwise it would be capped at about 3.54 billion.
Whoa. Everywhere is overpopulated. That's terrifying.
Yeah.
Oh.
So before Haber did his process in 1909, then there was actually a different scientist who was like, hang on guys, look, the population's booming because of Industrial Revolution.
Yeah.
Everybody's moving into the cities. We're headed towards mass starvation and huge famine. We need chemists to be working on a way to synthesize nitrates.
Yeah.
So scientists, and it's really interesting because the way they're talking about the future to do with nitrates is very similar to now with global warming and fossil fuels running out. It's so similar. Really, they were talking about that this is the major issue of our time.
Of our time, we need to quickly sort something out.
Yeah.
Wow.
And they did sort something out. So they found, Haber found the key to it was using an iron-based catalyst.
Okay.
As well as pressures of about 200 atmospheres. So each atmosphere is a so like two atmospheres would be twice our atmosphere on Earth.
Oh.
So 200 atmospheres is the equivalent of being 2 kilometers underwater.
Wow.
Yeah, a lot of pressure.
Yeah.
Which is obviously quite energy intensive.
Yes.
And dangerous. So you need, you know, these factories need a lot of health and safety.
Yeah.
And this comes to the other issue with the Haber process, and that is its impact on global warming.
Oh, God.
So this is... And it's really interesting because despite the fact that the Haber process accounts for 2% of global energy consumption,
yeah,
this one process,
wow,
2%, a is a lot. It's not really brought up for obvious reasons.
Half
the world's population depends on this.
Oh my word.
So the hydrogen is often obtained from methane, which is CH4.
Yeah.
So you remember you have the 3H2 reacting with the nitrogen.
Yeah.
So obviously that releases CO2.
Yeah.
Then you have the super high energy required to have the 200 atmospheres of pressure and also about 450 degrees C temperature.
Oh dear.
Yeah.
How many factories are there in the world?
I don't know, lots.
Oh dear. But it's like a catch-22 because if you get rid of the Haber process,
everybody, like half
the population dies.
Yeah.
Like Thanos wanted.
I was actually about to say that, but I was like,
I went there. Yeah. I took us there. Oh no.
So for obvious reasons it's not really included in the whole CO2 debate, but it's really important to actually know about this.
What is the solution?
So you can produce hydrogen a different way. You can produce it from the electrolysis of water.
Mm-hmm.
Now this requires electricity,
which still requires fossil fuels,
but can also use renewable energy.
Yeah.
At the moment, so electrolysis is better than just splitting up methane.
Yeah.
But to do it with renewable energy at the moment, it's easy to make renewable. They call it green ammonia. It's really easy to make, but not efficiently. It's really slow.
Okay.
So we need to work on making that more efficient.
Yeah.
So that when we run out of fossil fuels, we can still support
an overpopulated.
Yeah, because also if the Haber process runs out, I'm gonna guess that the first people who die are the people who can't afford organic food. So it's not gonna hit the rich upper class. It's gonna hit the poor working class
as
people.
As it always will.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's obviously we really want to avoid that. Obviously.
Yeah.
So the other issue is that this can release. So the other issue is that the Haber process can release nitrous oxide, which is laughing gas.
That is laughing gas.
Yeah. It's also about 298 times more potent as a greenhouse gas than CO2.
Oh no.
Yeah.
Oh, NOS is not good.
No.
Oh dear.
So every time you're, you know, just opening those canisters, letting it out into the atmosphere, you might want to, you know,
just be safe with your drugs. Be green with your drugs.
Or just don't do
drugs.
Oh
dear.
Yeah. So that's not ideal. Also, the other issue with nitrogen, it's a big fertilizer. Ammonia can dissolve in water.
Yes.
So you spray all this fertilizer on the fields, then it rains, all that fertilizer washes off into the rivers, into the streams, into the lakes.
Oh dear.
It causes eutrophication.
Oh no.
Which is a big biology word. And basically, this is when the ammonia fertilizes the algae in the water, causing big algal blooms.
Algal blooms. That's a difficult one.
Yeah. And this covers the surface of the water in like this green muck.
Yeah.
Stopping light coming in. It sucks all the oxygen out because the bacteria that breaks down the algae uses oxygen.
Yeah.
So all the fish die and all the plant life dies.
Oh no.
So you have these dead zones.
Oh no.
Obviously that's really not ideal.
No, not at all.
So less than 50% of fertilizer actually gets to the plants.
Oh no.
Yeah.
That's horrendous.
Yeah.
And no!
So, like, there are definitely ways we can improve this. So at the moment, we kind of just we have a field, we spray all of it with the same amount of ammonia.
Yeah.
Instead, what we can do is use drones to figure out what. So if you have a field, part of it's on top of a hill, the other part's slightly below it. The bit below is going to have a lot more ammonia because when it rains, it runs down.
Yeah.
So the drones would be like, this part needs less ammonia. This part needs more ammonia.
Yeah, yeah.
And so we can do that so that the ammonia we put in actually gets used by the plants instead of being excess and just running off
into the streams. Is there any way to stop it from running into water?
I mean, I feel waters. Like maybe if you built a wall around fields.
Yeah.
Like, but
I feel like that would then drown the...
Yeah.
That wouldn't work.
I'm not a farmer.
You're not a farmer. Me and my boyfriend.
I think the main thing we need to do is just use it more thoughtfully.
Yeah.
And like everything, one of the ways to do this, stop eating beef. Guys, just stop.
Okay.
I'm saying that to myself as well.
Okay.
So corn is one of the most intensively fertilised crops. It needs a lot of fertiliser.
Yeah.
Then that goes into cattle.
Cattle.
A lot of that's lost from, you know, because they use it to grow. They use it in their bones and stuff, but we're never going to eat.
Yeah.
They shit it out.
Yeah.
Lose it as heat. A lot of it's gone, and then we eat it, and we're losing so much of the original nutrients.
Yeah.
So if we switch to a more plant-based diet, that's better, because we're
directly getting the ammonia.
Yeah.
Oh. Because it's not like passing through another.
Yeah, exactly. Another, like anything.
Animal. That just makes sense.
Beef is just a really inefficient way of getting
nutrients.
Yeah, and actually also protein, apparently, is really inefficient.
Oh, right.
Because that was why I was always like, well, we need meat for protein, but apparently that's inefficient too. So,
oh, okay. Interesting.
Obviously, I'm not saying you can never have meat, but we should really be cutting down.
Yeah.
Because
it's not actually logical.
Yeah.
For health.
Yeah.
Okay.
Interesting. And obviously just reducing food waste.
Yeah.
In America, I was listening to this really cool agricultural podcast.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and they were saying their local restaurants aren't allowed to have any food waste.
That's really good.
I think it's in Texas.
That's really good.
So they either have to donate it to like homeless people, or they have to put it into compost.
Compost, yeah.
Yeah.
Cool.
Also, if farmers, there are also like benefits we can use for ammonia. So ammonia is actually a potential fuel source.
Mm-hmm.
So if we could produce it renewably, if we work on the technology for renewable energy conversion into ammonia, we can actually use the ammonia in hydrogen fuel cells.
Okay.
So for hydrogen cars, which are
hydrogen
great.
Hydrogen cars, yeah. We should do that.
I mean, at the moment, they're really
flammable, aren't they?
Yeah, hydrogen's super flammable.
So
you don't want to be storing hydrogen. But ammonia, we've already been storing ammonia in farms for ages.
Yeah.
So we can do that. And then that can be used in a hydrogen fuel cell. Also, really interestingly, there's some work on... So if you have renewable energy, the issue is while the sun's shining, the solar panel works. Once it stops shining, you've got no energy.
Yeah, it's just
you need a way to store it. At the moment, we use lithium batteries.
Right.
Unfortunately, lithium is obviously not an endless source.
Yeah.
So there's worries about that running out.
Oh, so even the renewable energy is dependent on a non-renewable.
Yeah, obviously. We can use the nitrogen that is renewable.
Yeah.
But
the lithium batteries.
Lithium batteries aren't renewable.
Yeah.
And guys, recycle your phone batteries.
Okay.
Recycle your phones. You have to, I think some Apple stores take them.
Okay.
Or if you go to like a dump, usually they have a place for batteries.
Mm.
Because lithium is not renewable. We need to keep it for as long as possible because electric cars also rely on it.
Mm.
It's just super important. So recycle. And
so many wholesome messages today.
So yeah, if we can store the energy as ammonia, then convert it back to nitrogen, release the energy, super super important. That'd be really good. But then also you can have farms producing nitrogen from like turbines.
Yeah,
so if they can use that turbine to power nitrogen and hydrogen reacting to form ammonia, they'd have to get the catalyst, obviously. But then that means that they can produce ammonia on a small scale.
Yeah.
And it's much better.
Proportionate to their farms.
Also, we should be having smaller farms, because small farms are more efficient, because farmers are more interested in using their fertilizer effectively. So they're more likely to do the direct and precision farming. So yeah, that's basically all the stuff I've got to say today.
Wow. So from World War One and the Holocaust to don't eat meat.
Well, from the colonization of India.
Yeah. Oh dear.
So basically
it's the empire.
That equation that you have to learn at school
is impacting
has such a cool history with a really bad role model.
Yeah.
And if they taught that, I reckon people would remember it a lot more.
Oh yeah, definitely.
So that's why I want to talk about it.
That's really cool. So I have brought Virginia Woolf today with me and three of her works.
Oh, so, you know, not much.
Yeah, not much. Definitely going to be able to talk about it in half an hour. Not. So Virginia Woolf, she was born in 1882 and died in 1941. She had a very interesting, very also tragic, but very intellectual life. She was born in an aristocratic family, so she's very upper middle class.
Okay.
And that's reflected in her books, at least the two I read, and then the essay that I have read of hers, which is called A Room of One's Own, which is very, very important feminist literature, critical literature, and kind of necessary for anyone who wants to look at feminist literary aspects. But yeah, so she was very interesting. She grew up in a family in which her brothers were able to go to Cambridge, but as a woman, of course, she couldn't. And so her and her sister had to make do with learning everything from their parents' library.
Oh, right.
She grew up and became a part of a very famous group of intellectuals, philosophers, writers and artists called the Bloomsbury Group, because they lived in an area in London which was called Bloomsbury.
Yeah,
so obviously. And that was a place in which they discussed radical things like politics and sex and the nature of art and
a very whether women should be equal.
Yeah, which obviously she thought yes. yeah, so she's extremely interesting as a person, and that's reflected in her amazing literature, which is
exciting.
Just as good as any man's. yeah, so she married Leonard Woolf, which is obviously why she's called Virginia Woolf.
The coolest name.
It's very cool, spelled W-O-O-L-F. There's two O's in there, just to make it extra interesting. Yeah, but she also had dalliances with a woman called... Dalliances, as in, like, romantic happenings. They were a very radical, very before-their-time group of intellectuals, so I think they were all kind of shagging and experimenting and in sexuality and stuff. And her books, especially one that I'm going to bring today, discusses the theme of transgender, lesbianism, you know.
That's so cool.
Very cool things.
And when was she born? Like
1882. Yeah. So she's part of a generation called the modernists, who lived through the First World War. And the First World War is massively reflected in their art. It's characterized by disillusionment because the war has just kind of blown apart the society of young people at the time, traumatizing them, and themes of shell shock are really important in another one of her very famous books called Mrs. Dalloway, which I will also be touching on today. So a queen, but she also suffered from bouts of psychosis in her life, which are also reflected in Mrs. Dalloway, through the character of Septimus Warren Smith, who is a ex-soldier who we would now think and diagnose him as a schizophrenic, because he suffers from delusions and has psychosis throughout the whole book, and that's an important stream all throughout. Yeah. I'll talk about that a bit later on when I talk more in depth about Mrs. Dalloway. But this came from her experiences of psychosis that would happen after she experienced a lot of grief, a lot of death. Mm. I believe 4 deaths. When she was 24, by the time she was 24, I think, of her family. And she also had sexual trauma as a child. So extremely damaged, as well as this amazing mind. She was so, so clever. And to write these works in a time where she would have been ignored by men, but also paving her way and her voice amongst this group, the Bloomsbury group of highly intellectual people, is really interesting because... And there's kind of themes of that, that the aristocratic wits is what she calls them. And that's explored in Orlando. In the 18th century. I will talk about it and it all makes sense when I go on to Orlando, but you see like the intellectuals of the day talking with one another. And Orlando, the character, is a part of that society at one point in his/her life. And it's kind of contrasting to the fact that Orlando, while she's a woman, is not really involved in the intellectual conversations during the 18th century. But it's interesting that Virginia Woolf was a definite prominent voice in her own in her own era, in her own time, but also consciously aware of the fact that through the voice of Orlando in her book, that men tend to not want to listen to the intellect of women. So she's extremely conscious, but rises above the pressures of...
And in modernism, that would have definitely... Like, the whole anti-feminism was... I mean, in art anyway, that was a real big thing.
Yeah, a huge thing.
Because I was like, wow, modernism is so cool. Then I read into it and I was like, oh no.
Oh no.
Oh baby no.
It's complicated. I mean, just like anything, it's multifaceted. Yeah. And she's a modernist as well as all of the other men in that time. But yeah, so she's just a tremendous mind. Unfortunately, though, she could feel the onset of another breakdown, nervous breakdown, another psychosis. And she left a note to her sister and her husband, Leonard, saying that I can feel I'm slipping back into madness again. And so she fills her clothes with stones and walks into a river and drowns and is found 3 weeks later.
Oh no.
Really sad. Yes. And unfortunately, that's a trend for female writers throughout history, and one she is so aware of in A Room of One's Own, which I will talk about. Perhaps I'll talk about it now because it fits really well with her life. It's almost like she was aware when she was writing A Room of One's Own that she was the character she was writing about. So A Room of One's Own is an essay. She writes it in her own voice. It's not fictional. It's a essay that she wrote in response to being asked to talk about women in fiction. And so the essay is actually, it's an essay, but it's also quite well written in the fact that it's kind of a narrative. And you follow her, or the essayist, through her trying to work out what she actually wants to say.
Yeah.
There's a lot to it, but she basically states that if Shakespeare had a sister, and she calls her Judith Shakespeare, who had the exact same capacity, the exact same intellect, was just as gifted in poetry and play writing, if she had tried to move from Stratford to London, as Shakespeare did in his life, and submit her plays to places, they would laugh at her, they would maybe listen to her for a bit just to appease her, and then they would use her and abuse her. Yeah. She'd likely become a prostitute, and then she'd end up killing herself because her intellect would have been ignored and rejected. Yeah. So while the male version of Shakespeare rose and is now one of the most legendary, and rightly so, legendary voices in our English language, if he had a sister, she would have died because of how awful it is to be that intelligent, but to be so disregarded.
Yeah. And I suppose, like, with her brothers going off to Cambridge, that must have been a real...
Yeah, she is Judith Shakespeare in a way, you know, when you start reading about her life. It's just really sad because she is Judith Shakespeare. She's so capable. I mean, you just have to read her writing, and I'll talk about it later on in more depth, but she was literally a part of the modernists who were paving a different type of prose.
Yeah.
Like a whole new way of writing consciousness in literature.
What was that?
Well, okay, I can talk about it, but yeah, so A Room of One's Own is extremely influential, and she, just to sum up A Room of One's Own.
Yeah, sorry.
So she talks about Judith Shakespeare, and then in respect to that intellectual thought process, she says, in order for a woman to write fiction just as well as men, she needs to have £500 a year, so obviously that wouldn't work in our day, but enough financial support to be independent of anyone, and also A Room of One's Own, and that's obviously the title of the essay. And she's really quite funny, and I was listening to a thing on BBC Radio 4 where Sarah Pascoe was saying if she was now, and Sarah Pascoe is exactly 100 years ahead in the future to Virginia Woolf, so born in 1982, Sarah Pascoe the comedian.
All right, yeah.
She was saying that if Virginia Woolf had been in our time and was born in 1982 instead of 1882, she would have been a comic, because she's really funny. Like, the beginning of A Room of One's Own is like, you may be wondering why A Room of One's Own has anything to do with women in fiction, and then blah, 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 blah. So she's very sarcastic, and she's very cheeky, and you can see that in both these books that I brought. Mrs. Dalloway, not as much, because it's quite dark themes, but yeah, she's really playful. And so she says that for women to write good fiction, they need financial stability and a room of one's own in which they won't be disturbed, because poetry cannot be written while you're being disturbed as a housewife by children, by the
role of women. I feel like that's just with any,
if you need to be surrounded by
distractions.
Yeah, any kind of work, including, obviously she was talking about literature because that's her aspect of expertise and knowledge. But yeah, like you say, it's true for any woman who wants to be successful.
Oh man, like, because you always talk about historically, like, the men would have a study in the house.
Yeah.
Where children weren't allowed to go.
Yes. So they have a room of their own.
Yeah.
But a woman doesn't and is not able to have that.
Or arguably that would be, historically, that would be the kitchen, which was her domain. But obviously, that was, if you were cooking, fine. If you want to write,
you can't. Not ideal. Yeah, not ideal. Too many distractions. And as a person who writes poetry myself, no, I own it, I'm a poet. Yes. you just can't write poetry while someone's disturbing you.
Yeah,
so she was completely right, and tragically she is Judith Shakespeare, because she ended up suffering so much. But again, like you say, her brother is being so annoying. She's amazing. Also, to add on to what Sarah Pascoe was saying, that if she was born in this time, I don't think she would have committed suicide at the age of 60. So anyway, you asked about the narrative form that she helps to curate and make. I'm not going to lie, it's challenging. And if you don't know anything about it, it's super alienating. Because I tried to read one of her very famous books called To the Lighthouse without any knowledge of what stream of conscious writing is like. Like any knowledge of the modernists and why they're doing it. And I think you need to understand why before you pick up a book that is written in this way. I'll explain why. Because basically, and especially Virginia Woolf, she believed that there was nothing that couldn't be written about. There was nothing so small, there was nothing so lesser that it couldn't be written. And she just rejected the fact that, you know, classic poems, epic poems, literature, plays, everything shouldn't be confined to aristocratic people. It shouldn't be confined to grand plots of revenge and jealousy and rivalries like the Shakespeare plays are written. It doesn't have to be Homer's Iliad or Odyssey, where there's amazing adventures and big men hurling sticks. She thought that everything was significant, and she was someone who would see details that we daily ignore. So, for example, one of her essays is literally just a rumination on watching a moth trapped in between two panes of glass and seeing it futilely try and escape. Everything was scope for literature. And also at the time, psychology is emerging, and something that is really interesting that I'd forgotten earlier to mention about, but as I was saying, she writes about transgender things, she writes about bisexual experiences, she writes about shell shock, she writes about challenging things, which, as a woman, that was not possible.
Yeah.
So her and her husband, Leonard Woolf, they literally set up their own publishing house called the Hogarth Press, which is so influential for the 20th century literature. Because here's a woman who's written this radical stuff, and she doesn't have to supplicate to publishers, change her name like the Bronte sisters had to. Yeah. She can publish under her name for her own literature, and that's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
The Hogarth Press is also responsible for publishing Freud in England, and T.S. Eliot. And T.S. Eliot then goes on to found Faber and Faber, which is specifically a poetry printing press. But yeah, so it's a bit amazing.
Just a bit.
Her and Leonard set up this press. This idea of the conscious stream is coming through, and is a way that Virginia Woolf and other writers such as James Joyce, who writes Ulysses, Ulysses is written in this style.
Oh, wow.
And so she was a part of this movement, and she was very aware that at that time they were finding a new way of writing prose. I think, like, she mentions that, you know, readers are going to have to bear with us because it's not going to be perfect. For writing it is going to be really interesting, because it's the discovery of how to literally capture someone's consciousness in writing. So why I was saying that it's quite difficult to read if you know nothing about it or anything is that it's like you've just been plonked into someone's headspace.
Yeah.
Which means there's no strict narrative structure. The way it's written is influenced by things triggering emotions and memories, so the subconscious is being triggered, and it conveys both the exterior and the interior experience of the identity. And this is philosophy that was at the time by Henry Bergson, that you have chronological historical time that is moving, you know, linearly, and each minute is followed by each minute, which then accumulates into hours, and there's the idea that time is moving forward, which is possibly a psychological trick that we have to employ to feel like we can sort the chaos of the world out. But That was a theory. And then also you have the internal clock. And things on the exterior can trigger memories from the interior mind. And the time of that space is not linear. And it's subjective. And it's extremely... So it's the idea that when you're enjoying something, time goes really fast.
Yeah.
Because the interior is working on a different clock to chronological time outside. Your body's aging, but you might feel like, whoa, you've just zoomed an hour, whereas an hour doing an exam or doing something really boring, that goes slower. Right. So, and also the fact that memories have their own time and space within the internal experience. So the book deals with that. The whole of Mrs. Dalloway is written in one day, one single day.
Like, June. Literally written, or just set in one day?
No, she wrote it over years.
Okay.
But it's...
I was like, wow, this is a thick book. I'm impressed.
No, she actually, this book was a labour to write. Because as she was saying, and she was conscious of, we're writing a new type of narrative, and she doesn't nail it until loads of writing, and there's been...
Yeah.
Loads of iterations of it. She had lots of changing ideas about how it should be structured and what characters should be more important. And a character, she has to go, oh, it doesn't really work. I have to insert this character to flesh it out more. And so, no, the actual writing of the book took a long time.
I feel like so much of the artwork and like literature, which is designed to come across as instantaneous, actually has so much like all the impressionist paintings where it looks like, oh, they've just put paint on and it suddenly worked. They've calculated where every brush stroke is gonna go,
100%.
And I feel like it's definitely,
and it's actually a talent to hide the fact that it has been a huge labor. Like, that's almost more impressive than just being able to smash out a book perfectly. Or, you know, a piece of music perfectly, to make it sound or read effortless.
Yeah.
And, like, you're literally stepping into someone's head and moving through a day. So...
It's so clever.
It's I highly recommend. And, yeah, it is difficult because you're moving in someone's head, and the way your brain works is not a linear thing.
Yeah.
Which is going back to the philosophy and psychology of exterior and internal time.
Yeah.
And, so, for example... In the book, Mrs. Dalloway is the key character, but it jumps from different people's consciousness throughout the day with, like, uniting experiences. So it's a book that goes micro, macro, in and out, all the time. And I'll talk about the influence of cinema on it as well, because it is relevant. So, for example, there's, in London, on this day, people are writing, there's, like, a plane writing in the sky, which was also an interesting thing that was happening at the time, that people were... deciding to use the technology of airplanes and for advertising and stuff, and that became like a massive sensational thing. And I think the government got really scared that the sky would be like covered in writing, and that there'd be too much busyness going on, and that, so there's loads of laws I think that aren't relevant now, but we're trying to stop that. I think that's
something. I mean,
anyway, so this event is happening, and there's other things that sort of connect in the macro world that then influence different consciousnesses. So you move with Mrs. Dalloway, but then you kind of, she notices, like, for example, a car that's moving past that is clearly that of a high status person. It might be the Prime Minister, it could be the Queen. And those thoughts, the speculations of everyone in London around, who is that, did someone catch a glimpse, is, she uses that the object of the car and also the sky plane writing to zoom up into describing it and then zoom into someone else's brain and how they're responding. That's to this so cool. event. It's really cool. But again, really difficult because it slides forward.
Yeah.
And the way your brain thinks things, it, you know, gets triggered by something external and then goes on this crazy path through loads of things, and then those things trigger more thoughts and conversations and things and people, and oh, and then you're back to the policeman stopping you from crossing the road, but then your brain is still going. And so the way it's written is hard to keep a grasp onto, because even in a sentence you might forget what the trigger was in the beginning. So it's very fluid, it just moves like water through your hands. So there isn't like, and also nothing really happens, I'm putting that in quotation, like, it's again, as I was saying before, she didn't think that anything was not worth writing about.
It's the kind of beauty of normalcy.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. 100%. It's the interest that can come out from just a walk through London.
Yeah.
Not the great tragedy of kings who have married their mums and then stabbed their eyes out because they didn't realise. That's actually... I'll probably talk about Oedipus at some point.
You could do it with Freud.
Yeah, okay, I will. The Oedipus and Freud episode will happen at some point. Yes. So it's extremely difficult to grasp onto because it moves in that way. But it's fascinating. She's done it. Like, it's amazing how fluidly you move into different brains. But you've just got to catch yourself. You've got to be on it because you're like, oh, wait, who am I with now? Like, the characters have changed. And she just drops in names as if it is the person's brain. So they know who Peter Walsh is. But then you're like, who's Peter Walsh? And you have to infer all of these complex backstories to every character. And she talked about how each character had a cave behind them. Like a cave of history behind them.
Yeah.
But she obviously doesn't sit there and write their history.
Because
that's ridiculous. But she writes... She knows their whole life, almost.
Yeah.
And the way she writes it is as if that person is going through their life and things would naturally trigger those memories.
Yeah.
So as a reader, you have to... It's very rereadable because you know that you've missed so much. And you learn things each time you read it because you're literally in someone's head as if you dropped into their head at the age of 60, which is what Mrs. Dalloway, Dalloway is. So she's got a tremendous amount of history and a tremendous amount of memories that are resurfacing on this particular day. She's taken back to her lesbian gallivants with her friend Sally Seaton. And she, you know, she's always constantly going forwards and backwards into space and time.
Yeah.
Being influenced by the external and then that in turn... influencing her time and space in her memories.
Yeah.
See, it's fantastic. But like I was saying, the framing device of and the technique of having external things to fix on, so the plane and the car, that allows you to zoom into someone else's brain, who was Septimus, who I was talking about earlier, the World War I veteran who is suffering from schizophrenia.
Yeah.
So you jump from a sane mind to an insane mind, and it starkly contrasts how everyone is reacting completely different in their own headspaces to things that everyone is seeing, experiencing. So it's just an amazing comment and picture of the very colourful array of consciousnesses that are all moving and interacting around each other. But also within themselves.
Yeah, definitely.
It's really interesting. Also, the you get impressions, kind of like Hamlet impressionists, and I'll talk about how painting influences.
I'm just looking this time at as well. This cover is also beautiful.
Yeah, I'm about to show. I'm going to talk about this cover at some point, but so she wrote prolifically in diaries at this time, which is so useful because you get to see her working process, which is why we know so much about. How hard it was for her to write this book, because she writes loads of letters to people, she writes in her diaries about this book, and she says that she's writing this to T.S. Eliot, who is famous poet boy at this time.
Was he Do Not Go Gently?
No, that's Dylan Thomas. He's The Wasteland and the love song of J. Alfred Prufrock. I'll do a T.S. Eliot
okay.
then. It was well. I don't like him that much, but I won't go on into it. So she says to him, I think it's him, but it's a letter anyway. Mrs. Dalloway has branched into a book, and I adumbrate here a study of insanity and suicide, the world seen by the sane and the insane side by side. And that's definitely what it is.
Yeah.
And she's perfectly nailed it. Kind of gave it a little bit away of the story, but a suicide is like the climax of the story. And, but there's so many themes in this book, I could literally go on. But I don't really want to dwell too much on Mrs. Dalloway. Even though I want to, but it's just so much. Okay, I've already spoken for half an hour, it's very annoying.
It's fine.
Okay, so talking about the influence of cinema on both Orlando and Mrs. Dalloway, which are the two novels that I'm bringing today. Cinema was emerging and she was consciously aware that this was going to be a very influential medium of art that was going to influence everything. And the way it works the both Mrs. Dalloway and Orlando, but Orlando less so possibly, is this these great cinematic shots, and I can literally visualise all of the, I can visualise that day in London, and I can visualise so much of what happens in Orlando, because she zooms in, she pans, she goes into people's consciousness, she can zoom out again and go into someone else's brain. So it's different to a first person narrative in which you're stuck with one person and you don't get to hear what other characters around them think of that person.
Yeah.
So the this style of writing, you have this helicopter holistic view of each character as it flips into people's consciousness. So there's a bit where Septimus is walking in the park with her, with his wife, and a Scottish girl comes up to them and asks for directions. And it's, you start with this, the both Septimus and his wife, who's called Rezia, who's Italian, and their internal monologue. She's really worried about the fact that he's talking to himself, and that, you know, she's with this very mentally disturbed person. And then Septimus is in his mind, where he thinks the planes are speaking to him. It's, they're called delusions of grandeur. He thinks that they're writing to him specifically, that God is sending him messages, that he's the Messiah, and that his very poor and broken narrative is explored throughout the whole book. And then it flips into the Scottish girl who's visiting London, who's like, oh, that was really odd. So you get the impression, both inside the wife, who is really anxious about the fact that Septimus is acting like that. Septimus is completely unaware brain of anything in the external world in terms of reality, in quotation marks, to how we would say. And then it flips into someone completely different who is observing that those dynamics and being like, oh, that was very queer, and oh, you know, being, and then you flip into another person in the park who's walking, who's looking at that girl and then thinking about her life. And so it works really fluidly in that way, but again, it's kind of hard to keep track. And in a way that's so cinematic.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. And it also, the cubists at the time in art were also wanted to capture consciousness and activity. This is a cubist painting that I'm talking about, the cover of my book.
It's a really nice cover, actually.
I'll put it on the Instagram because it's really interesting.
It's a really interesting, because like, you've got bits down where, so the painter has accentuated a face on the front with really different texture, and then also the sky.
Yeah.
So you're kind of drawn to the face and the sky as kind of the two different narratives.
Yeah.
The sky obviously being the helicopter, and then the narrative from the person.
This is perhaps the person who's walking along the road. It's the painting is called The Sensation of Crossing the Street, which is very fitting. It was painted before Mrs. Dalloway was written. It's very fitting for the for the book, because it describes walking through London. There's like a tram carriage kind of appearing at the top of the painting, and you just get a sense of movement, and there's a clock here, so time is happening.
You can kind of capture
figures who are walking, this person is possibly shaking hands with that person.
It's
all really fluid.
I could talk for so long about it.
It's absorbing, and sometimes you can kind of look at and think, oh, there's nothing happening there, it just looks a bit odd, because we kind of want to see the classical, perfectly rendered, you know, Rembrandt's like beautiful, like human, perfectly, like as if it's been a photograph of someone. This is obviously extremely different, and it can alienate people, just as the style of writing can alienate people. Because it's something that
cubism was also about, showing things from every perspective at once.
Yes.
So there's a really famous one called Model Descending a Staircase.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember the guy's name. It'll come to me in like 10 minutes, but
we'll put it on the Instagram anyway.
But that was about viewing this kind of figure from every angle, and at the time people were like, what is this? But it's such a good painting, and it is exactly like what you're talking about, the narrative
this
style.
Narrative. And that was perfectly it. You wanted to capture everything all the time. So the book certainly reflects the painting that the cover holds. And it's really cool that all of these different mediums, like the introduction of technology and planes and cars in motor cars,
that's a really big influence on modernism,
and that's all there in the narrative of Mrs. Dalloway that just creates the scene of London so perfectly, and then hopping into people's consciousness, and so much is explored within. I mean, this is only 200 pages.
Wow.
It's so dense, and again, like, people are like, oh, well, nothing happened. Like, there's no like big fight scene at the end or anything. But the point is that it's creating the impression of a whole day in London from, like the Cubists wanted, from every perspective in time and space. And time is a really important part of the book as well. There's a clock that chimes periodically so that the reader is aware, is aware of the external time that is happening. So, because obviously you're swept away through time and space and the different personalities and processes and periods of time in each character's life. So it can be quite difficult to grasp where's reality. But the clock is like a thing that anchors the reader to the day. Like, we're still in this day.
Yeah.
Even though the book travels through people's memories into different times and eras.
Yeah.
Which is really cool. Yes, so moving on to Orlando, because I loved this book so much. It's literally my favourite. I think it's literally my favourite book. And I'm just going to show, I bought this from a charity shop, and this exact copy was published in the 70s. It wasn't written in the 70s, obviously.
Yeah.
But this copy of the book, and it literally fell apart as I read it.
I love that.
I'm just showing Beth.
It's all the adhesive is just...
It's just crumbled. It literally was crumbling as I would read. Like, the first bit kind of snapped off, and I was like, oh no. And then just as I kept going, it's in, like, 5 segments of book, which is really sad. But it was such a good book. It was so good. Okay, so Orlando. Orlando, you start with him as a aristocrat in the 16th century, towards the end of the reign of Elizabeth the First, and he lives for about 400 years in this book.
Oh,
he/she, and not quite halfway through the book, it's like just under, he changes gender one day. He wakes up, he goes into these coma type sleeps, which are a really interesting aspect of the book, which I'd love to dig more into. And the way it's written as well is similar to the conscious dream, but it's not quite like that. You get, like, the impressions of other people, but you stay with Orlando pretty solidly. But it's also written as if the author is a biographer, like a historian who is researching an actual real person. So Orlando is fictional, but the way the book is written is really meta, because it's as if he is real as a person, and this book is actually a real history of someone's life. It's not fiction. And I think there's even a mention to the price that the Hogarth Press will sell this for. So there's a literal mention to Virginia Woolf as a writer. Again, she's really funny. She's really clever. She's very sarcastic.
I just forget that she's even written this, because it's so...
It's huge. Radical for even our brains. Like, we're just now... And it's still really a contentious time dealing with different types of people who don't experience gender in a binary way. And this book, it's just so cool. Like,
I love it.
From the whole themes. I'm just going to show Beth the cover of this book as well.
So beautiful.
So yeah, it's a portrait of a detail of a painting circa 1637, which is about the time that we start with Orlando's narrative at the age of 16, attributed to Cornelius Nui of the Sons of the 4th Earl of Dorset at Knowle. The painting is of a young aristocratic boy, which is what Orlando begins as, but it's very androgynous.
Yeah, definitely.
He could also be a girl. He's got long, flowing, luscious hair. He's kind of got... He obviously hasn't started puberty that well, because... And the hair is kind of hiding an angular jaw. He's got very soft features, and it almost, you can convince yourself, it is a woman.
He's got very, like, effeminate eyebrows as well.
Yeah.
Like...
And a nose that's quite delicate and a quite juicy.
Yeah, I would think then it, you just hit the chin, and then you, that, yeah, that suddenly there's like
makes the, it masculine.
There's a shadow under the lips, which just adds a little masculine, like
almost like a little beard. It's not a beard. It's a almost, shadow.
Yeah,
but it kind of looks like you could convince yourself, like if you put it further up, like
if I covered up the chin, I could easily see that as a woman.
Yeah. Oh, 100%. I literally just covered the chin, and yeah, it's feminine.
It's the chin that makes it masculine.
But then that looks like a man, doesn't it?
Yeah.
I've just covered the face.
Yeah.
So it's a fascinating painting and an excellent choice for the people yeah. chose to for this book, because it literally looks like Orlando, who from the very beginning is fluid.
Yeah.
In how people see him, but he genuinely he is a man at the beginning and is recognised as that, but his love interests, as it goes on and throughout the whole book, it's always there's always a question of gender.
Mm.
So he falls in love with this for this figure. There's a massive, and I think this was accurate in history as well. There was a massive frost during the Jacobean period, in which the Thames froze completely.
Mm.
And it talks about that Orlando and the aristocrats skating on the completely frozen ice.
Yeah,
it's really cool as a setting, but I think that genuinely happened in history. Like yeah, the Thames completely froze did. And they had fairs and stuff on it. So he sees this Russian ambassador, I guess. Well, just a Russian, also an aristocrat, but a Russian visitor to the English court. And as they're skating across the ice, he immediately falls in love with. And in an infatuation with this figure, but can't decide, can't figure out if it's a man or a woman.
Oh, right.
And it's a really, it's so cinematic. I can literally see
yeah.
the figure coming across. And Orlando is an extremely emotional person. He's a poet himself, mm. so he feels things really vividly. And so he's like, oh, I'm in love. Oh, it's a man, and I can't love you. And it's the fact that it's not that he doesn't. Still, it's not that he's still sexually attracted to this figure.
It's
that he couldn't.
It's the social
surroundings.
Yeah.
It's not because that ardor goes away immediately with the oh, it could be a man. It's that
yeah.
oh, I wouldn't be able to act on my feelings if it's yeah. a man. It ends up actually being a woman, who is wearing a Russian trouser type.
Yeah.
The fashion of the time. And he was like, no, it can't be a woman. No woman can skate so vigorously across the ice. And but it is. Yeah. Sasha is a woman, and they have this. Yeah, he's married, and he goes off, and they have like cheeky sex along the Thames, and
on the Thames.
Yeah, oh. yeah. They skate and skate further out of the city. Remember, it's Tudor times as well, so you know. Not as populated as it is now, it
True. Wouldn't
be possible. It's frozen, and everyone has congregated into... They're either huddled in their homes, peasants are either dying, huddling in their homes, trying to find water, or everyone who has money has gone to the city yeah. to have warmth and where all the food is stored. So they're able to have this amazing romance, and he's naive throughout the whole thing, and you kind of watch it like, she's going to leave, and he wants to run away with her. Ah, he sees her Russian ship sailing off, and he's extremely heartbroken by that experience. So I won't explain the whole story, but he becomes an ambassador, and one night he just wakes up. Oh no, yeah, so he has these coma type sleeps, so nothing can wake him up. It's like he's dead, but he's still breathing.
Yeah.
Literally it's quite comical and cinematic. They bring in trumpets and cymbals and like try and scratch him with like a bush, and there's like people dancing and singing trying to wake him up, but he can't wake up, and he won't. And that's his first coma sleep, which I think is supposed to stop him from aging,
mm.
or at least slow down his aging, because time works very differently in yeah. Orlando. Like I said, she lives for 400 years.
Mm.
The book ends at the point where she stopped writing the book. So she goes, oh, she starts at a point, and it ends on the day, which is the 11th of October, 1928. It ends as she writes it. So Orlando still lives. Yeah. We don't know what happens to her when she, so she becomes a man.
Becomes a woman.
I mean, she becomes a woman, yeah. And I want to read out the bit where she transforms. When she wakes up from transforming.
Mm.
Because it's just so, again, you forget that this was written 100 years ago.
Yeah.
And it's so relevant now. Okay. The sound of the trumpets died away, and Orlando stood stark naked. No human being since the world began has ever looked more ravishing. His form combined in one, the strength of a man and a woman's grace. As he stood there, the silver trumpets prolonged their note, as if reluctant to leave the lovely sight which their blast had called forth. And the chastity, purity, and modesty inspired, no doubt, by curiosity, peeped in at the door, and threw a garment like a towel at the naked form, which, unfortunately, fell short by several inches. Orlando looked himself up and down in a long looking glass, without showing any signs of discomposure, and went, presumably, to his bath. We may take advantage of this pause in the narrative to make certain statements. Orlando had become a woman, there is no denying it, but in every other aspect and respect, Orlando remained precisely as he had been. The change of sex, though it altered their future, did nothing whatever to alter their identity. Their faces remained, as their portraits prove, practically the same. His memory, but in the future we must, for convention's sake, say her for his and she for he. Her memory, then, went back through all the events of her past life without encountering any obstacle. Some slight haziness there may have been, as if a few dark drops had fallen into the clear pool of memory. Certain things had become a little dimmed, but that was all. The change seemed to have been accomplished painlessly and completely, and in such a way that Orlando herself showed no surprise at it. Many people, taking this into account and holding that such a change of sex is against nature, have been at great pains to, one, prove that Orlando had always been a woman, two, that Orlando is at this moment a man. Let biologists and psychologists determine. It is enough for us to state the simple fact. Orlando was a man till the age of 30, when he became a woman, and has remained so ever since.
I love that. So beautiful.
There's just so much to talk about in that, isn't there?
Like, it's just so stunning. Relevant.
It's so stunning.
Yeah.
Like, he was a man, now she's a woman. Nothing else has changed.
Yeah.
There's so much in that, isn't there? And it's so powerful. And I just want trans people to read this.
Yeah.
Because it's so positive. And I also want to read, I promise I won't read the entire book to you, but I really want to read, so she basically, now she's a woman, she lives with some gypsies for a long time, but eventually she decides, no, I want to go back to England, to my massive estate. And I was thinking, oh, what her servants gonna how are they gonna treat her? I was like, oh no, is there gonna be a big tragedy? She's gonna return home and then you're a woman now, no, get out, blah 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 blah, and deny any kind of financial security, which I think if this was real, that probably would have happened. But like, her return home is really, it's so beautiful. It was a fine evening in December when she arrived, and the snow was falling and the violet shadows were slanting much as she had seen them from the hilltop at Brusa. The great house lay more like a town than a house, brown and blue, rose and purple in the snow, with all its chimneys smoking busily as if inspired with a life of their own. She could not restrain a cry as she saw it there tranquil and massive, couched upon the meadow. As the yellow coach entered the park and came bowling along the drive between the trees, the red deer raised their heads as if expectantly, and it was observed that instead of showing the timidity natural to their kind, they followed the coach and stood about the courtyard when it drew up. Some tossed their antlers, others pawed the ground as the step was let down and Orlando alighted. One, it is said, actually knelt in the snow before her. She had not time to reach her hand towards the knocker before both wings of the great door were flung open, and there, with lights and torches held above their heads, were Mrs. Grimstitch, Mr. Dupper, and a whole retinue of servants came to greet her. But the orderly procession was interrupted first by the impetuosity of Canute, the elk hound, who threw himself with such ardour upon his mistress that he almost knocked her to the ground. Next, by the agitation of Mrs. Grimstitch, who, making as if to curtsy, was overcome with emotion and could do no more than gasp, "Milord, milady, milady, milord," until Orlando comforted her with a hearty kiss upon both her cheeks.
After that, Mr. Dupper began to read from a parchment, with the dogs barking, the huntsmen winding their horns, and the stags, who had come into the courtyard in the confusion, baying the moon. Not much progress was made, and the company dispersed within after crowding about their mistress, and testifying in every way to their great joy at her return. No one showed an instant suspicion, but Orlando was not the Orlando they had known. If any doubt there was in the human mind, the action of the deer and the dogs would have been enough to dispel it, for the dumb creatures, as is well known, are far better judges both of identity and character than we are.
I love that so much.
Ah! Oh my god. I love it. I love it so much. I've got nothing else to say. She says it.
Yeah, literally.
Well, just that.
Read the book, guys.
Read the book. It's so good.
Okay, guys, thanks for listening to this episode. Really hope you enjoyed it. Please check us out on Instagram and Facebook at interested.podcast.
Yeah.
You can also email us at interested.podcasts.
With an S on the end.
Yeah, at gmail.com. I'll also put that in the show notes.
Uh-huh.
And yeah, just let us know if there are any topics that you'd really like us to cover. It doesn't just have to be science and English.
No.
I'm also an art student, so I'm probably going to be covering some art scene.
We spoke about art today. That was exciting.
I know, that's made me so excited. So yeah, I'm just thinking about all the people
next
on
week.
The cover.
I'm excited. Yes. And as I'm saying, I'm definitely going to talk about psychology and history and other things like that. So it's not all going to be feminist literature, but
so
maybe it will be.
So if you have any topics you'd like us to cover, or if you have any ideas, you think, oh, I think this could be better, email us, let us know.
Some people responded on Instagram to they were interested in. Let me try and think from the top of my head. Someone said creative design, which is cool.
Oh, okay.
Someone said antinatalism, and question to the person who did ask that, I'll tell you after, but I don't want to say their name just in case they don't want to have their name said. They said antinatalism, and I don't know if that was, are they interested because they don't know about it, or are they interested because they do? Do they want to know more about it? Because I can definitely do more on antinatalism and the philosophy behind it, because I am an antinatalist. That was a question to that person out there.
Yeah.
What someone else said...
ancient civilizations, someone
said.
Oh
my gosh, yes.
I agree.
Definitely.
Also, conspiracy theories. That was really interesting for you guys. I'll put another poll on Instagram.
Yeah,
If there are other people who want to... Tell us what they're interested in, and we'll talk about it. And maybe it'll inspire us like it has done today, that we'll, you know, might talk about conspiracy theories.
Maybe.
Or antinatalism.
Yeah.
I'm always going to make mistakes, as we are infallible humans. I mean, fallible humans.
We're humans.
I literally just messed up on saying that. We are messy people. I was saying Archangel Michael last week. Bless my mother, she told me that I was very wrong in my secular.
It's actually Archangel.
It's spelled arch like a
doorway.
Like a doorway, but it's arch as in the ark that Noah built. So apologies to all of the religious people who were cringing while I was saying Archangel.
Yeah.
I said it so many times as well. That was a painful thing. So again, I'll be apologising next week.
It's fine, we make mistakes. If we actually make mistakes and you wanna correct us, like, we're always interested to know.
Definitely.
Sometimes it'll just be, oh, okay, I just made a mistake. But if there's something you think please let us know. We can talk about it in the next episode. We're happy to admit that we don't know everything because we're not experts.
Exactly. This is a podcast for interested people.
Yeah.
It's not for big dons.
No.
You know, and actually learning that we were wrong about something is just as exciting as
definitely
being right about something.
Yeah.
You know, love to hear all of your opinions as well.
Yeah.
We speak about interesting stuff.
Yeah.
Like Orlando. Wow.
Yeah. cool. See you guys next week.
Bye.